You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Just over 2 years ago, President Bush announced a surge of U.S. troops in Iraq to provide additional security in Baghdad and al-Anbar province. The policy not only increased the number of troops in Iraq, but also changed the mission and tactics of American forces. Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas E. Ricks, a special military correspondent for The Washington Post, has written a book about the surge and its creation called The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. It's published by Penguin Press, and it brings Mr. Ricks back to this show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Does this book pick up where your previous one, Fiasco, left off?
Very much. It's the account of the last couple of years of the war, kind of a secret history of what really happened.
And you begin with an account of a previously secret American military report about a massacre of Iraqi civilians by U.S. Marines in Haditha. Why start the book with that incident?
Because the Haditha incident really showed the bankruptcy of the old way of war. I only found out after publishing the book just very recently that after killing 24 civilians that day in this Iraqi village of Haditha, the Marines didn't even file what's called a SIGACT, a Significant Actions Report, reporting it up the chain of command. 24 dead civilians. It wasn't even seen as that different. It was business as usual. And this is the type of war we've been fighting for several years, in fact, as long as this country fought World War II. And it was only in the winter and spring of 2007 that we began operating differently and more effectively.
And you write that the United States almost lost the war in Iraq in 2005. Lost? Did the situation get really that bad? Is Haditha is an example of the reason we were losing it?
We were heading downhill fast. It's not just my conclusion. Actually, in the book, I reprint a slide from a Pentagon study of the war done in the fall of 2006 that states we are losing this war. And I think the thing that really changed the course of the war, oddly, was the midterm elections of 2006, which was like a two-before over the head of President Bush. It told him, you are losing this war. You are losing the American people on it. They are not buying what you're selling. And it's no accident that the day after the midterm elections, Donald Rumsfeld was fired as Secretary of Defense. And in the following months, an entirely new chain of command was put in control of the war, both the generals and senior civilians. A new strategy was implemented. And in many ways, in the spring of 07, the war was turned over to the dissidents. For example, Ambassador Ryan Crocker reveals in the book that he had essentially opposed the invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Several other people that were brought in to deal with the war as advisors to generals had been opponents of the war or opponents of the way it was being executed. They even brought in foreigners, two of the most important advisors to Petraeus and General Odierno back in this period were pacifist foreigners, one of them a woman, one of them a Palestinian-American. It really showed Americans were finally showing a little bit of humility about how to operate in Iraq and showing a willingness to listen. And that had been lacking for several years in our operations
there. Now, why do you think the Bush administration was so confident of its own strategy despite what were very clear signs of its failure? Why did it take losing the midterm elections? It sounds to me like if they hadn't, if Americans had decided to stick with what they already had, for whatever reason, they did when George Bush was reelected, that we probably wouldn't have changed.
I think that's right. I think we would have ridden this downhill train for several more months. And eventually, I might have seen the American people just in disgust say, let's get out of there. Might have seen the Iraqis just kick out the Americans. It was not working. And really, everybody on the ground in Iraq knew it, including the U.S. military.
You write that the idea for the surge came from a small number of U.S. officers led by General Petraeus, as well as retired officers, military historians, and conservative defense intellectuals. What did they recognize about the Iraqi conflict that the Bush administration hadn't?
Well, it's actually funny because there were people inside the Bush administration who did recognize this, but the word was not getting through. It somehow wasn't being taken on by President Bush. But people around Bush understood this was not working. There were two problems. First, getting the top people to listen, like Rumsfeld. The second thing was coming up with an alternative. It was very difficult to say, here's a different way of going about this. It was very difficult for the military to adjust. And as I show in the book, the entire chain of command involved in this, except for General Raymond Odierno, opposed the surge.
Now, It's been suggested that the reason that Rumsfeld remained in office so long is that he was protected because of his relationship with Vice President Cheney. Is that true? Is that enough of a reason to keep on going on with a failing policy?
I think that was a big part of it. Cheney and Rumsfeld go way back. They're close friends. They bought houses together on Maryland's Eastern Shore. They spent a lot of time with each other. And I think Cheney also was, interestingly, the vehicle through which these retired generals, most notably General Jack Keane, began to talk to the White House and said, this is not working. You need to get serious here. And it's really, oddly enough, only in December 06 that President Bush asserts civilian control of the military. He has a meeting with General Keane and some other people, and they say, you need to stop judging your generals by whether they're, quote unquote, good guys. You need to start judging them by whether they're militarily effective. And it's only then that policymaking and decision-making on Iraq starts to work.
You describe General Odierno as the true father of the surge. He had to use certain tactics to get the White House to even pay attention to his ideas.
Yeah, it was a lot of backdoor dealings, him talking to General Keane. And the regular military, the chain of command, was vigorously opposed to this. At one point, before General Petraeus had been appointed to command the number one slot in Iraq, but when he thought he might be going out, he was talking a lot to General Odierno by telephone. Odierno was already out in Iraq. And General Casey, then the commander in Iraq, sent the word to Petraeus, knock it off, stop talking to Ray. They were telling General Keane, bug out, get out of this, you're a retired general, stop bothering us. The uniformed military, the people in charge at that point, were quite happy to continue on the path they were on.
Many of Petraeus' closest advisors went to Iraq extremely pessimistic, and one admiral, William Fallon, then Petraeus' superior, even sent an admiral to Baghdad in the summer of 2007 to come up with a strategy to replace Petraeus.
Yeah, it was really striking how isolated these guys were. This was a minority within the military, kind of an insurgency within the military, facing a lot of opposition. Even now, there are people in the military kind of say, oh, Petraeus, no, Odierno, that was a flash in the pan. That's not what we want to be doing here. There were a lot of people who would have been happy, I think, to see them fail because, you know, these were the guys who were saying, you're not fighting the war right. These were the dissidents. It was striking to me that my book, Fiasco, was read by a lot of the people involved in this, and it actually opened a lot of doors for me in Iraq over the last 3 years.
Well, if they still think that Petraeus and Odierno were a flash in the pan, what would they like, a return to the failed policy that preceded, or do they have a third policy approach?
They didn't really. It was more that the Pentagon was kind of asleep at the wheel. There was a lack of seriousness about dealing with this. They were persisting in peacetime policies. They were insisting on protocol, like Admiral Fallon. Well, I'm your superior officer, so you need to be polite with me. These were guys out in Iraq who were determined to try to fix a really bad situation. Maybe they'd been opposed to the war. Maybe they thought it had been run wrong. But they were walking in and saying, look, this is our last chance. Let's really try to do it right. So, for example, Petraeus says to his subordinates, I want all of you to act as if this is your last tour of duty in the military. Don't worry about your futures. Do it now. And also, we will all leave Iraq with our integrity intact, an implicit criticism of their predecessors.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, whose latest book is The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008, published by the Penguin Press. So what had General Petraeus's thoughts been about the invasion of Iraq in the first place and the way that the occupation had been set up?
During the invasion, Petraeus famously asked a reporter, my Post colleague Rick Atkinson, tell me how this ends, showing a certain skepticism about the entire adventure. Then in his first...
Wouldn't that have hurt him?
I think a lot of people in the military were worried. Remember Jack Keane, then the number two man in the Army, had advised against the invasion and said, keep your eye on the ball. And the ball is Afghanistan and Pakistan. Don't do Iraq. Capture Osama bin Laden. After his first tour in Iraq, Petraeus went back to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and presided over the writing of a counterinsurgency manual that was published in December 2006 and really was a very effective critique of how we'd been operating in Iraq. And when he and Odierno come in, they really changed the American approach. The most important aspect of the surge was not more troops. it was that they said our top job here, our number one priority, is to protect the Iraqi people. Sounds like common sense, but until then, the top priority of the American mission had been toss the ball to Iraqi security forces, pass it off, pass security responsibility to the Iraqi army and Iraqi police. Petraeus and Odierno come in and say, time out. You've been trying this for years. It's rushing to failure. Let's first try to calm the situation down. Move out into the population. Well, to do that, you need more troops, and that's where the additional troops come in. Another theme of this book is just how tough that was. The spring of 07, I think, was the hardest phase of the war, at least so far. And by the way, I don't think this war is anywhere near over.
But in the spring, and we'll get to that.
In the spring of 07, they had to fight their way from these big bases into the population. The enemy, the insurgents, the Shiite death squads, knew that they didn't want this to happen. When you're on a big base and you do a patrol once a day in a neighborhood, you may be there for 1 hour a day. The opposition has it for the other 23 hours and can intimidate anybody who might cooperate with you. When you move in, you're there 24 hours a day. You can respond much more quickly. And more importantly, you get to know people. You get to recognize what's right and what's wrong, what's normal. But the fight was hard. I know one unit that encountered more than 50 bombs just trying to move in to this building it was trying to get into in a neighborhood. Another unit trying to move in gets in a firefight with the insurgents. In the middle of the firefight, a sergeant looks up and sees two Iraqi kids paralyzed with fear standing in the street. Gets up, grabs the two kids, sticks them under his arms, and rolls over to a corner to protect them. And a soldier said later, that's when we won the firefight. It didn't matter whether we killed or captured the insurgents. The neighborhood saw Americans protecting Iraqis. And it also was action. It was no talk. After 4 years of this war, Iraqis no longer believed the Americans. They'd had promises made and promises broken. They'd seen allies surface and then be executed by al-Qaeda. The only thing that was going to work was seeing American actions, and that's what this did.
But many analysts have said that the drop of violence in Iraq during the past 2 years has been largely the result of the surge. But you say that although it has worked militarily, it has failed politically.
Yeah, I think there's no question of that. It worked in improving security. But that was not the goal of the surge. As stated by the President and the Secretary of Defense, the purpose of the surge was to lead to a breakthrough in Iraqi politics.
Well, what happened with these recent elections? You don't see them as all that hopeful?
No. Elections in Iraq tend to be destabilizing. Remember the purple fingers of a couple of years ago? 6 months later, you had a civil war. That election hardened sectarian differences. It remains to be seen what the results of this election are. We like elections in this country because we have contention and then everybody kind of shakes hands and we have cooperation of some sort. At least people agree to the new regime. In Iraq, elections frequently are the starting gun for sectarian differences. They're going to have three rounds of elections this year. The third round, the general national election, is going to be in December, and that's just as you have fewer American troops on the ground. So it may be a recipe for more violence.
We saw yesterday with 16 people being killed, 45 wounded, when twin car bombs exploded at a bus terminal and market area in southwestern Baghdad, that the surge isn't working completely. Is that kind of an anomaly, or can we continue to expect that sort of thing to happen?
Oh, I think you'll have that sort of thing for many years to come. I think we're going to have American troops in Iraq for a long time. Ambassador Crocker says in the last line of my book, the events for which the Iraq war will be remembered have not yet occurred. And this is someone who's been the top diplomat there for the last couple of years, an expert in Iraqi politics in the Arab world. I think we're to be there for many years to come. General Odierno predicts in the book that in the year 20, or he says in the book that in the year 2015, he'd like to see 35,000 U.S. troops still there. I think he's probably right.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, who is the Washington Post special senior Pentagon correspondent. He covered the U.S. military since 2000 there. Before that, he had a similar beat at the Wall Street Journal. He is a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting. He's reported on U.S. military activities all around the world, and he's the author of Fiasco, Making the Core, A Soldier's Duty, and now The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. It's published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We We're back with Thomas E. Ricks, who's written a book called The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008, published by the Penguin Press. And you mentioned earlier that Petraeus filled his staff with people we don't normally expect to see in this sort of thing, former combat military officers with doctorates from elite universities, foreigners who served as his top advisors. One of the consultants you mentioned, Emma Skye, was openly a pacifist. Why these people? Didn't he know that that would really just rub the military brass the wrong way?
I think he did, but General Petraeus is accustomed to being an outlier in the U.S. military already. He's an unusual character. He likes talking to journalists, enjoys talking to politicians, and has a PhD from Princeton in international relations. So there's three strikes against him right there in the eyes of most of his peers. Yeah, I think why they were doing this was they realized it was time for the Americans to start listening. We've been telling Iraqis and the world about Iraq for many years. Finally, we started showing some humility, some tactical patience as well. And to bring in people, Emma Skye, anti-American, anti-military, British expert in the Middle East, is signed up as a political advisor to General Odierno. Now, I beat the hell out of Odierno in my first book, Fiasco, on the Iraq War. And he's really one of the villains of that book. I argue that as commander of the 4th Infantry Division, his tactics, his methods helped inflame the insurgency. When he comes back to Iraq for his second tour, he calls up Emma Skye, who has just finished reading Fiasco, and says, I'd like you to be my political advisor. And she says, okay, General Odierno, on one condition. The first time I see you commit a war crime, I'm reporting you to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. He chuckles and says, okay. They were really willing to take some risk here. This was part of the gamble.
And you say that as long as Donald Rumsfeld was defense secretary, it would have been difficult to reorient the war in Iraq. Why do you think he held out so long?
I think he was like an aging fastballer who's just not got the mustard on the ball he used to, refuses to recognize it, is getting shelled, and says, pay no attention to the scoreboard. Another way of putting it is that Rumsfeld makes mistakes, but everybody makes mistakes. Rumsfeld's flaw, his tragic flaw, was his inability to adjust, to recognize that, say, you know, that ain't working. Let's try a different course here. Let's really think this through.
Well, do you think that President Obama made the right choice in keeping Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense?
I thought it was a very interesting choice, and, yeah, a very effective choice for this reason. Essentially, the transition to Obama began in Iraq in January 2007, when they put in this new team of effectively dissidents and people who really disagreed with the way the war had been handled. When they signed up as advisors, people like Emma Skye or Petraeus's advisor, Saadi Othman, a Brazilian-born Palestinian-American who on 9/11 was a taxi driver in New York City, really wanted to do something about America and the Middle East, became friendly with Petraeus when he was an interpreter, and really started advising Petraeus, and also is the first man in the history of Jordan to dunk a basketball in university competition. He's a 6'7" tall Palestinian, and by the way, also educated by the Mennonites and something of a pacifist himself.
Well, the dunking the basketball would impress the president, this current president. You write that Elliot Cohn, a counselor to the Department of State when the surge was first implemented, told President Bush in December 2006 that he should stop judging generals as good guys and instead evaluate them by their military effectiveness. This sounds like the sort of thing that happened during the Civil War.
It did. And I think it was in many ways Bush's finest moment, December of 2006, January 2007. He finally asserts civilian control of the military. He finally starts making strategic decisions, which is actually taking risk and making hard decisions rather than everybody kind of humming along.
And you say that Cohn cited what Lyndon Johnson did during the Vietnam War as a similar kind of failing.
Yeah, the myth about Johnson is that he was in micromanaging because he got involved in picking targets. Actually, his great failure in Vietnam was not forcing his joint chiefs to speak honestly to him about their differences. And there were grave differences inside the Pentagon about the conduct of this war. There were real doubts about whether it could succeed. The job of the commander-in-chief is to surface and explore those doubts. Instead, Bush, with his emphasis on loyalty and his dislike of dissent, had suppressed those doubts until they were no longer avoidable.
Now, John McCain emphasized the surge during the campaign, but you describe him as essentially detached from reality.
Yeah, McCain was a supporter of the surge and a big booster of Petraeus. But McCain has continued to subscribe to this grandiose notion of Iraq being a stable democracy in the middle of the Middle East that then becomes a beacon of transformation. And one of the things that nobody in this country seems to have noticed is that Petraeus and Odierno radically downsized American goals in Iraq. It no longer was about transforming the Middle East. It was simply about trying to kick the can down the road far enough so you might have a chance of a essentially stable, relatively nonviolent Iraq that wasn't going to start a regional war. And if it turned out to be a democracy, that would be great, but nobody even expected it to be an American ally.
Well, how far down the road will we kick that can? You predict that we're likely to have American soldiers engaged in combat in Iraq until at least 2015.
Yeah, I think we may be about halfway through this war.
Hasn't the president talked about getting troops out a lot earlier, or has his recent hemming and hawing on this suggested that maybe he has gone through some kind of a reevaluation?
Well, President Obama campaigned on a promise to have combat troops out of Iraq in 16 months. Newsflash for Barack Obama, the phrase combat troops is meaningless. There are no pacifist wings of the U.S. military. And as long as you have troops in Iraq, some of them are going to be fighting and dying. Now, I think where they're going to arrive at between the generals and the president is a notion of a post-occupation force, maybe 35,000 troops, which is about the minimum you can get to if you're going to be there and trying to influence the behavior of Iraqis and especially Iraqi security forces.
So would that be more like what we've seen in Korea?
No, the difference is in Korea, the fighting stopped after a couple of years. Here, I think we're going to be engaged in combat in some form, counter-terror missions by special operators, advisors out working with Iraqi forces. I think we're going to be seeing violence there for some time.
And you say this could be America's longest war.
Yeah, we're on track for it to be America's longest war.
So how long do you think we should maintain the surge's troop levels?
One of the things that has characterized the American mistakes in this war is a persistent over-optimism about when we can bring the troops down. Remember, the original American plan was to be down to 30,000 troops by the fall of 2003. Well, here we are more than 5 years later, and we're still at 155,000 troops. I think they will reduce the troop numbers. They're not going to reduce them by anything what Obama supporters thought they would. It'll come down more slowly because I think they really don't want to lose control. And the easy.
Well, what would happen if we did leave Iraq in 16 months?
I think that's probably the Jerry Rubin solution, if you remember the old yippee. I think we'd sit back and groove on the rubble, and it would be rubble. I think you'd start seeing the Shiite government really misbehaving with the Sunnis. I think you'd see armed Sunnis fighting back. I think the Kurds would start getting frisky, and that would probably provoke more Turkish intervention than we've seen, although we've seen some Turkish intervention already.
Well, that could lead to the Biden suggestion before he changed his mind to break the country up into three separate parts.
And we may be on that track. That's one reason I say the surge failed is none of these questions have been answered. What's the future of Iraq? How do they share oil revenue? Is it going to be a tightly controlled central government? Is it going to be a loose confederation? That's what the surge was supposed to lead to, a political breakthrough. But none of this has been addressed. That's why I say the surge at best gets a solid and complete for kicking the can down the road. On the other hand, what's the alternative? The alternative might have been a bloody civil war, genocide, or a regional war. In that case, kicking the can down the road, while not satisfying, might have been the best of a bunch of bad choices.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for a number of projects he did at the Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, now his follow-up, The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008, published by the Penguin Press. I should also point out that you're publishing a blog on the Foreign Policy website?
Yes. If you go to foreignpolicy.com, it's a blog called The Best Defense. Which I find oddly less like journalism and more like book writing. You have to have your facts, but also have to have a voice. And I also want to mention.
And you have to respond to critics, don't you? I mean, don't
maybe.
People leave comments? And
I do like the interactivity of it. I just did a series on a little-known battle in Afghanistan that raised a lot of questions, and I wanted to do it online partly to provoke responses and trade back and forth. I was also able to post the documents I was using so I could be transparent and say, here's the document, here's my interpretation, what do you think? I also want to mention that I'm a fellow now at the Center for a New American Security, a smart little boutique think tank in Washington. It's the little think tank that could. Unfortunately, half the people in it are going into the Obama administration, so I'm feeling kind of home alone these days.
It's been suggested that General Petraeus has tried to shape the media coverage for Obama's combat troop withdrawal plan to advance his political agenda, his policy agenda, maybe his personal political interests. Do you see any truth in that?
I don't think that David Petraeus has any political ambition. I've known him for a long time, I think since he was a lieutenant colonel. He's a hugely ambitious man, but his ambition is to be a great captain, to be a leader of the military, to shape the military. I think the career plan he would like is to be next be Army Chief of Staff and then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for maybe 15 years. He's not that old. He's in great shape. He loves showing how he can do thousands of one-arm push-ups. He's a runner, even though he was shot in the chest and smashed his pelvis in a parachute accident. But I think what he is trying to do is express himself clearly on policy. He has strong views. There was a bit of friction with him last summer when Obama went out to Washington, went out to Baghdad. Petraeus felt that Obama really hadn't heard him out in congressional hearings. And when Obama came to Baghdad, he was on Petraeus's turf. And unusually, Petraeus essentially lectured him for 90 minutes. He didn't have the kind of conversation you'd have with a visiting senator and presidential candidate. Kind of sat down and said, look, these are the facts of the matter. It was surprising to me that it was so contentious because they really are similar men, lean, smart, ambitious, rather more cerebral and reserved than a lot of their peers, and essentially agree on Iraq.
Well, he's also a major source for this book, so I assume you developed some kind of personal relationship with him.
I'm not sure I have that personal relationship with David Petraeus. He's a rather remote and cool guy. The surprise to me was Odierno. You know, having really pushed him hard in fiasco, he was very open and very candid with me in a series of interviews. All of the interviews I did with these guys, hundreds of hours, were embargoed into publication of this book. Odierno could have just told me to get lost, but instead actually sat down and talked.
Now, you mentioned that we might be there to 2015.
If we're lucky.
The economist,
we might
Joseph
be there to
Stiglitz.
2025.
Oh, boy. Joseph Stiglitz has estimated that the final cost of this thing will run into the many trillions of dollars when you add in all the medical and other veterans' benefits over the coming years. And we're going through a serious financial crisis. Can we afford to keep this going? After all, it's created great deficits, and we have the added deficits created by all the other things that we're doing in the bailout.
I think we can't afford it, but we can't afford not to. And this is the devil's dilemma that's been passed to Barack Obama. He has inherited probably the biggest foreign policy mess that any president has ever inherited. And the scary thing, it's not even his number one problem. The number one problem is obviously the economy. And that's not just Iraq. Pakistan, Afghanistan is a scarier problem. And it's Pakistan of that war is the bigger problem. There's no solution really out there. Again, we might just be trying to kick the can down the road. But if Pakistan breaks up, you face the project of Islamic extremists with nuclear weapons. That's al-Qaeda's dream, and it's our nightmare.
Well, it's been said that Iran is the ultimate winner of this war in Iraq. Do you think that's true?
I'd agree with that so far. Iranian influence is across the Iraqi government and in parts of Iraq. The people that we think of our allies are in many ways closer to Iran. I think the ultimate really sovereign Iraq that comes to exist, if it is one country, will be closer to Tehran than it will be to Washington.
In one of your blogs, you said that the Afghan war is not a good war. Well, President Obama has suggested that we should focus more on Afghanistan. Will we have any success there? Do we need a surge there?
I love Afghanistan. I lived there from 1969 to 71 with my family. My father was teaching there. I went back in 77 when I graduated from college just to knock around. I'd be happy if I never saw Iraq again. Afghanistan I'd go on vacation to. It's a beautiful country, fascinating people, kind of Clint Eastwood with turbans. With that in mind, no war is a good war. War, I think, having been in the middle of several of them, is a psychotic state in which people stop acting like people. And so I don't like to call any war a good war. Afghanistan was supposedly the little war that could. I think you take a closer look, and it's not been. There have been a series of missteps there. At the very beginning, we lost the chance to capture Osama bin Laden because of mistakes by General Franks and others. We took our eye off the ball in 2002 when we started focusing our national security establishment on Iraq. We have not had an effective policy there. We've wasted several years there. We have alienated a lot of Afghans. And yesterday in downtown Kabul, you had a major Taliban attack on the Ministry of Justice at the same time that the Taliban is launching credible attacks inside Pakistan. There was video on Al Jazeera last week of Pakistani tanks running away from a Taliban attack. That's scary stuff.
You have posted a blog in which you suggest that we establish a truth commission for the Bush era. There's been resistance to that from the Obama administration.
Yeah, this is the, you know, no drama Obama thing. I think we need to know what has been done in our name. I'm kind of a one-issue voter on this. I hate the idea of this country torturing people. I think America's name was dragged through the mud of torture. And I want to know what happened. I'm not really talking about frontline people. I don't blame frontline troops for some of the massacres they've committed. I blame the people who put them in that situation and the leadership. So I want to know who okayed torture, how it was done. What I'd love to see is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like South Africa, where they say, if you come forward, we will grant amnesty. But after a date certain, no more amnesty will be granted, and you can be prosecuted for those acts.
It probably would make many Americans feel better about what's happened, but it might also help our image abroad. Do you think that that has been seriously damaged?
There's no question in my mind it's been damaged. I remember walking in Italy, in Sicily, in a small town, and seeing a one-word black graffiti on the wall, Guantanamo. And that word came to mean that Americans are a bunch of hypocrites who talk about human rights, but when they got attacked, they panicked and they began torturing.
Thomas E. Rick's latest book is called The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq 2006-2008, published by the Penguin Press. Are you finished with this story, or do you see a third book in the works?
I probably see a third book in the works, but I'm not going to do it for another 10 or 15 years.
Oh, really?
Because this thing's not going to be over until then. And I want to take a break. And my head's been so in this stuff since 9/11.
Well, I'm sure you have a lot of things that you weren't able to get into this book or to other things that you've written.
My next book, I'm going to look at, I think, a history of American generalship. One of the questions I have in my mind is, why did we hold generals accountable in World War II? 17 division commanders got fired. These days, you can't get fired if you lose a war.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.